the players won or lost per hand relative to the stakes they were playing. Because near-term wins and losses are very much subject to luck, I applied a statistical procedure to estimate what the players' true long-term profitability was. I then ordered the players by their skill level and broke them down into 10 equal-sized quadrants. The top quadrant, consisting of the top 10% of the player pool, corresponds to the best player at a typical 10% table. The bottom 10%, meanwhile, are the biggest fish. I crafted a bar chart that represents my estimate of how skilled the players in each quadrant really are, measured as money won or lost per 100 hands in a no-limit hold'em game with $5, $10 blinds. The chart includes both money won and lost to the other players and that lost to the casino, which either takes a small percentage of each pot, known as the rake, or charges an hourly fee for dealing the game. I estimate that the very best player at the table in one of these games is averaging a profit of about $110 per 100 hands played over the long run. That's a nice wage in an online casino, where hands are dealt very quickly and you could get almost that many hands during an hour or two. It's less attractive in a traditional casino, where it might take 4 hours to play the same number of hands, and translates to a wage of $25 or $30 per hour. The key insight, however, is that the worst players at the table are losing money much faster than even the best ones are making it. For instance, I estimate that the worst player in the game, the biggest fish, was losing at a rate of more than $400 per 100 hands. This player is so poor that he would literally be better off folding every hand, which would cost him only $150 per 100 hands instead. Here you see the statistical echo of the 80-20 rule. There's a much larger difference between the very worst players and the average ones than between the average ones and the best. The better players are doing just a few things differently from one another, while those at the lower end of the curve are getting even the basics wrong, diverging wildly from optimal strategy. In the classic poker movie, Rounders, Matt Damon's character advises us that if you can't spot the sucker in your first half hour at the table, then you must be the sucker. I don't think this is quite true. It may be that the game doesn't have any suckers. It is emphatically the case, however, that if you can't spot one or two bad players in the game, you probably shouldn't be playing in it. In poker, the line between success and failure is very thin, and the presence of a single fish can make the difference. In the game I just described, the one fish was feeding a lot of hungry mouths. His presence was worth about $40 per 100 hands to the other players. That subsidy was enough that about half of them were making money, even after the house is cut. Poker abides by a trickle-up theory of wealth. The bottom 10% of players are losing money quickly enough to support a relatively large middle class of break-even players. But what happens when the fish, the sucker, busts out, as someone losing money at this rate is bound to do? Several of the marginally winning players turn into marginally losing ones. In fact, we now estimate that only the very best player at the table is still making money over the long run, and then less than he did before. What's more, the subtraction of the fish from the table can have a cascading effect on the other players. The one who was formerly the next-to-worst player is now the sucker, and will be losing money at an even faster rate than before. So he may bust out too, in turn making the remaining player's task get more challenging. The entire equilibrium of the poker ecosystem can be thrown out of balance. How, in fact, do poker games sustain themselves if the worst players are a constant threat to go broke? Sometimes there are fishy players with bottomless pockets. PokerKingBlog.com has alleged that Guy Laliberté, the CEO of Cirque du Soleil, lost as much as $17 million in online poker games in 2008, where he sought to compete in the toughest high-stakes games against opponents like Dwan. Whatever the number, Laliberté is a billionaire who was playing the game for the intellectual challenge, and to him this was almost nothing, the equivalent of the average American losing a few hundred bucks at blackjack. Much more commonly, the answer is that there is not just one fishy player who loses money in perpetuity, but a steady stream of them who take their turn in the barrel, losing a few hundred or a few thousand dollars and then quitting. At a brick-and-mortar casino like the Bellagio, these players might wander in from the craps tables or from one of its nightclubs, or after going on a winning streak in a tournament or a smaller stakes game. In the online poker environment of my experience, the fish population was more irregular and dependent on the regulatory environment in different countries, the amount of advertising that the poker sites were doing, and perhaps even the time of year. During the poker boom years, however, the player pool was expanding so rapidly that there was always a wealth of fishes. That was about to change. The poker bubble bursts. In October 2006, the outgoing Republican Congress, hoping to make headway with values voters before the midterm elections, but stymied on more pressing issues, passed a somewhat ambiguous law known as the Unlawful Internet Gambling Enforcement Act, UIGEA. The UIGEA, strictly speaking, didn't make online poker illegal. What it did, rather, was to target the third-party companies that facilitated the movement of money into and out of the poker sites. Sure, you could play poker, the law said, in effect, but you couldn't have any chips. Meanwhile, the Department of Justice began targeting companies that were offering online gambling to Americans. David Carruthers, the CEO of an offshore site known as Bet on Sports PLC, was arrested on a layover in Dallas while changing planes on a trip from the United Kingdom to Costa Rica. Other prosecutions soon followed. All this scared the hell out of many online poker players, as well as many of the proprietors of the games. Party Poker, then the largest online poker site, locked Americans out of the games 2 weeks after the UIGEA passed. Its stock crashed by 65% in 24 hours. Other companies stayed in business, developing workarounds to the new law, but it had become harder to get your money in and riskier to take it back out. I had made most of my money from Party Poker, which advertised aggressively and was known for having the fishiest players. During the two-week grace period after Party Poker made its announcement but kept the games open to Americans, the games there were fishier than ever, sometimes taking on a Lord of the Flies mentality. I had some of my winningest poker days during this period. Once Party Poker shut Americans out, however, and I shifted my play to tougher sites like Poker Stars, I found that I wasn't winning anymore. In fact, I was losing. A lot. About $75,000 during the last few months of 2006, most of it in one horrible evening. I played through the first several months of 2007 and continued to lose, another $60,000 or so. At that point, no longer confident that I could beat the games, I cashed out the rest of my money and quit. My conclusion at the time was that the composition of the player pool had changed dramatically. Many of the professional players, reliant on the game for income, had soldiered on and kept playing. But most of the amateurs withdrew their funds or went broke. The fragile ecology of the poker economy was turned upside down. Without those weak players to prop the game up, the water level had risen, and some of the sharks turned into suckers. Meanwhile, even before the new law passed, my play had begun to deteriorate, or at least cease to improve. I had hit a wall, playing uncreative and uninspired poker. When I did play, I combined the most dangerous trait of the professional player, the sense that I was entitled to win money, with the bad habits of the amateur, playing late into the evening, sometimes after having been out with friends. In retrospect, things worked out pretty fortunately for me. The extra time I had on my hands, and my increased interest in the political process following the passage of the UIGEA, eventually led to the development of 538. And while it wasn't fun to lose a third of my winnings, it was better than losing all of them. Some players who continued in the game were not so lucky. In 2011, the Black Friday indictments filed by the Department of Justice shut down many of the online poker sites for good, some of which proved to be insolvent and did not let players cash out their bankrolls. I've sometimes wondered what would have happened if I'd played on. Poker is so volatile that it's possible for a theoretically winning player to have a losing streak that persists for months or even for a full year. The flip side of this is that it's possible for a losing player to go on a long winning streak before he realizes that he isn't much good. Luck versus skill in poker. Luck and skill are often portrayed as polar opposites, but the relationship is a little more complicated than that. Few of us would doubt, for instance, that Major League Baseball players are highly skilled professionals. It just isn't easy to hit a baseball thrown at 98 miles per hour with a piece of ash. And some human beings are a wee bit more refined in their talent for this than others. But there is also a lot of luck in baseball. You can hit the ball as hard as hell and still line out to the second baseman. It takes a lot of time for these skill differences to become obvious. Even a couple of months' worth of data is not really enough. I've plotted the batting averages achieved by American League players in April 2011 on one axis, and the batting averages for the same players in May 2011 on the other one. There seems to be no correlation between the two. A player named Brendan Ryan, for instance, hit 184 in April, but 384 in May. And yet we know from looking at statistics over the longer term, what baseball players do over whole seasons or over the course of their careers, that hitting ability differs substantially from player to player. Poker is very much like baseball in this respect. It involves tremendous luck and tremendous skill. The opposite of poker would be something like tic-tac-toe. There is no element of luck in the game, but there isn't much skill either. A precocious second grader could do just as well as Bill Gates at it. Still, it can take a long time for poker players to figure out how good they really are. The luck component is especially strong in Limit Hold'em, the game that I specialized in. Correct strategy in this game implies that you will scrap and fight for many pots, and staying in so many hands to the end means that a lot depends on the luck of the deal. A very good Limit Hold'em player in a game where the betting increments are $100 and $200 might make $200 for every 100 hands played. However, the volatility in his results, as measured by a statistic called standard deviation, is likely to be about 16 times that, or about $3,200 for every 100 hands. What this means is that even after literally tens of thousands of hands are played, a good player might wind up behind, or a bad one might wind up ahead. I've modeled the potential profits and losses for a player with the statistics I just described. The chart shows the plausible ranges of wins and losses for the player, enough to cover 95% of all possible cases. After he plays 60,000 hands, about as many as he'd get in if he played 40 hours a week in a casino every week for a full year, the player could plausibly have made $275,000 or have lost $35,000. In essence, this player could go to work every day for a year and still lose money. This is why it is sometimes said that poker is a hard way to make an easy living. Of course, if this player really did have some way to know that he was a long-term winner, he'd have reason to persevere through his losses. In reality, there's no sure way for him to know that. The proper way for the player to estimate his odds of being a winner, instead, is to apply Bayesian statistics, where he revises his belief about how good he really is on the basis of both his results and his prior expectations. If the player is being honest with himself, he should take quite a skeptical attitude toward his own success, even if he is winning at first. The player's prior belief should be informed by the fact that the average poker player, by definition, loses money, since the house takes some money out of the game in the form of the rake, while the rest is passed around between the players. The Bayesian method described in the book, The Mathematics of Poker, for instance, would suggest that a player who had made $30,000 in his first 10,000 hands at a $100, $200 limit hold'em game was nevertheless more likely than not to be a long-term loser. Are poker delusions? Most players, as you might gather, are not quite this honest with themselves. I certainly wasn't when I was living in the poker bubble. Instead, they start out with the assumption that they are winning players until they have the truth beaten into them. Poker is all about people who think they're favorites when they're not, Duan told me. People can have some pretty deluded views on poker. Another player, Darce Billings, who developed a computer program that competed successfully against some of the world's best limit hold'em players, put it even more bluntly. "There is no other game that I know of where humans are so smug and think that they just play like wizards, and then play so badly," he told me. "Basically, it's because they don't know anything, and they think they must be godlike. And the truth is that they aren't. If computer programs feed on human hubris, then in poker, they will eat like kings." This quality, of course, is not unique to poker. As we will see in Chapter 11, much of the same critique can be applied to traders on Wall Street, who often think they can beat market benchmarks like the S&P 500 when they usually cannot. More broadly, overconfidence is a huge problem in any field in which prediction is involved. Poker is not a game like roulette, where results are determined purely by luck and nobody would make money if they took an infinite number of spins on the wheel. Nor are poker players very much like roulette players. They are probably much more like investors, in fact. According to one study of online poker players, 52% have at least a bachelor's degree, about twice the rate in the U.S. population as a whole, and four times the rate among those who purchase lottery tickets. Most poker players are smart enough to know that some players really do make money over the long term, and this is what can get them in trouble. Why we tilt. Tommy Angelo pursued a poker dream before it was cool. In 1990, at the age of 32, he quit his job as a drummer and pianist for a country rock band to play poker full-time. "I was hooked on it," Angelo told me when I spoke with him in 2012. "I loved the idea of being a professional poker player when I first heard the words. The whole idea was so glorious, of not having a job. It's like you're beating society, making all your money on your wits alone. I couldn't imagine anything more appealing." But Angelo, like most poker players, had his ups and downs. Not just in his results, but also in the quality of his play. When he was playing his best, he was very good. But he wasn't always playing his best. Very often, he was on tilt. "I was a great tilter," Angelo reflected in his book, Elements of Poker, referring to a state of over-aggressive play brought on by a loss of perspective. "I knew all the different kinds. I could do steaming tilt, simmering tilt, too loose tilt, too tight tilt, too aggressive tilt, too passive tilt, playing too high tilt, playing too long tilt, playing too tired tilt, entitlement tilt, annoyed tilt, injustice tilt, frustration tilt, sloppy tilt, revenge tilt, underfunded tilt, overfunded tilt, shame tilt, distracted tilt, scared tilt, envy tilt, this is the worst pizza I've ever had tilt, I just got showed a bluff tilt, and of course, the classics, I gotta get even tilt, and I only have so much time to lose this money tilt, also known as demolition tilt." What Angelo eventually came to realize is that, for all his skill, his periodic bouts of tilt prevented him from doing much more than scrape by. As we have seen, it is considerably easier to lose money at poker when you play badly than to make money when you are playing well. Meanwhile, the edge, even for a long-term winning player, is quite small. It is quite plausible for someone who plays at a world-class level 90% of the time to lose money from the game overall if he tilts the other 10% of the time. Angelo realized the full extent of his tilt problems once he was in his 40s, after he had started writing about the game and coaching other players. He is naturally a perceptive person, and what started out as strategy sessions often turned into therapy sessions. "I was coaching so many different types of people with so many different types of problems related to poker," he told me. "The problems were very easy to see in another person. I'd say, here's a guy that's just as smart as me, and I know for a fact he's delusional about his skill. And I know that if everyone else is delusional, I have to be too." Every poker player tilts at least to some degree, Angelo thinks. If someone came up to me and said, "I don't tilt," my mind registers, "There's another delusional statement from a delusional human. It happens all the time." I had my own types of tilt when I played poker actively. I wasn't one of those throw stuff around the room type of guys, nor would I turn into a crazy maniac when I tilted, trying to play every hand, although my A game was wild enough. Sometimes I'd even tighten up my game a bit. However, I'd play mechanically, unthinkingly, for long stretches of time and often late into the night. I'd just call a lot and hope that the pot got pushed my way. I'd given up deep down on really trying to beat the game. I realize now, I'm not sure that I did when I was playing, what my tilt triggers were. The biggest one was a sense of entitlement. I didn't mind so much when I wasn't getting many cards and had to fold for long stretches of time. That, I realized, was part of the statistical variance in the game. But when I thought I had played particularly well, let's say I correctly detected an opponent's bluff, for instance, but then he caught a miracle card on the river and beat my hand anyway, that's what could really tilt me. I thought I had earned the pot, but he made the money. By tilting, I could bring things back into a perverse equilibrium. I'd start playing badly enough that I deserved to lose. The fundamental reason that poker players tilt is that this balance is so often out of whack. Over the short term, and often over the medium term, a player's results aren't very highly correlated with his skill. It certainly doesn't help matters when players have an unrealistic notion about their skill level, as they very often will. We tend to latch on to data that supports our theory, Angelo told me, and the theory is usually, I'm better than they are. Beyond results-oriented thinking. In the United States, we live in a very results-oriented society. If someone is rich or famous or beautiful, we tend to think they deserve to be those things. Often, in fact, these factors are self-reinforcing. Making money begets more opportunities to make money. Being famous provides someone with more ways to leverage their celebrity. Standards of beauty may change with the look of a Hollywood starlet. This is not intended as a political statement, an argument for or against greater redistribution of wealth or anything like that. As an empirical matter, however, success is determined by some combination of hard work, natural talent, and a person's opportunities and environment. In other words, some combination of noise and signal. In the U.S., we tend to emphasize the signal components most of the time, except perhaps when it comes to our own shortcomings, which we tend to attribute to bad luck. We can account for our neighbor's success by the size of their home, but we don't know as much about the hurdles they had to overcome to get there. When it comes to prediction, we're really results-oriented. The investor who calls the stock market bottom is heralded as a genius, even if he had some buggy statistical model that just happened to get it right. The general manager who builds a team that wins the World Series is assumed to be better than his peers, even if, when you examine his track record, the team succeeded despite the moves he made, rather than because of them. And this is certainly the case when it comes to poker. Chris Moneymaker wouldn't have been much of a story if the marketing pitch were, "Here's some slob gambler who caught a bunch of lucky cards." Sometimes we take consideration of luck too far in the other direction, when we excuse predictions that really were bad by claiming they were unlucky. The credit rating agencies used a version of this excuse when their incompetence helped to usher in the financial collapse. But as a default, just as we perceive more signal than there really is when we make predictions, we also tend to attribute more skill than is warranted to successful predictions when we assess them later. Part of the solution is to apply more rigor in how we evaluate predictions. The question of how skillful a forecast is can often be addressed through empirical methods. The long run is achieved more quickly in some fields than in others. But another part of the solution, and sometimes the only solution when the data is very noisy, is to focus more on process than on results. If the sample of predictions is too noisy to determine whether a forecaster is much good, we can instead ask whether he is applying the attitudes and aptitudes that we know are correlated with forecasting success over the long run. In a sense, we'll be predicting how good his predictions will be. Poker players tend to understand this more than most other people, if only because they tend to experience the ups and downs in such a visceral way. A high-stakes player like Dwan might experience as much volatility in a single session of poker as a stock market investor would in his lifetime. Play well and win. Play well and lose. Play badly and lose. Play badly and win. Every poker player has experienced each of these conditions so many times over that they know there is a difference between process and results. If you talk with the very best players, they don't take any of their success for granted. They focus as much as they can on self-improvement. Anyone who thinks they've gotten good enough that they've solved poker, they're getting ready for a big downswing, Duan told me. Angelo tries to speed the process along with his clients. We're walking around in this cloud of noise all the time, he said. Very often we don't see what's going on accurately. Angelo's methods for achieving this are varied and sometimes unconventional. He is an advocate of meditation, for instance. Not all his clients meditate, but the broader idea is to increase their level of self-awareness, encouraging them to develop a better sense for which things are and are not within their control. When we play poker, we control our decision-making process, but not how the cards come down. If you correctly detect an opponent's bluff, but he gets a lucky card and wins the hand anyway, you should be pleased rather than angry, because you played the hand as well as you could. The irony is that by being less focused on your results, you may achieve better ones. Still, we are imperfect creatures living in an uncertain world. If we make a prediction and it goes badly, we can never really be certain whether it was our fault or not, whether our model was flawed or we just got unlucky. The closest approximation to a solution is to achieve a state of equanimity with the noise and the signal, recognizing that both are an irreducible part of our universe, and devote ourselves to appreciating each for what it is. Chapter 11. If you can't beat 'em. In 2009, a year after a financial crisis had wrecked the global economy, American investors traded $8 million in stocks every second that the New York Stock Exchange was open for business. Over the course of the typical trading day, the volume grew to $185 billion, roughly as much as the economies of Nigeria, the Philippines, or Ireland produce in an entire year. Over the course of the whole of 2009, more than $46 trillion in stocks were traded, four times more than the revenues of all the companies in the Fortune 500 put together. This furious velocity of trading is something fairly new. In the 1950s, the average share of common stock in an American company was held for about 6 years before being traded, consistent with the idea that stocks are a long-term investment. By the 2000s, the velocity of trading had increased roughly 12-fold. Instead of being held for 6 years, the same share of stock was traded after just 6 months. The trend shows few signs of abating. Stock market volumes have been doubling once every 4 or 5 years. With the advent of high-frequency trading, some stocks are now literally bought and sold in a New York microsecond. Economics 101 teaches that trading is rational only when it makes both parties better off. A baseball team with two good shortstops, but no pitching, trades one of them to a team with plenty of good arms, but a shortstop who's batting 190. Or an investor who is getting ready to retire cashes out her stocks and trades them to another investor who is just getting his feet wet in the market. But very little of the trading that occurs on Wall Street today conforms to this view. Most of it reflects true differences of opinion, contrasting predictions about the future returns of a stock. Never before in human history have so many predictions been made so quickly and for such high stakes. Why so much trading occurs is one of the greatest mysteries in finance. More and more people seem to think they can outpredict the collective wisdom of the market. Are these traders being rational? And if not, can we expect the market to settle on a rational price? A trip to Bayesland. If you follow the guidance provided by Bayes' theorem, as this book recommends, then you'll think about the future in terms of a series of probabilistic beliefs or forecasts. What are the chances that Barack Obama will be reelected? That Lindsay Lohan will be arrested again? That we will discover evidence of life on another planet? That Rafael Nadal will win at Wimbledon? Some Bayesians assert that the most sensible way to think about these probabilities is in terms of the betting line we would set. If you take the idea to its logical extreme, then in Bayes land, we all walk around with giant sandwich boards advertising our odds on each of these bets. In Bayes land, when two people pass each other by and find that they have different forecasts, they are obliged to do one of two things. The first option is to come to a consensus and revise their forecasts to match. If my sandwich board says that Nadal has a 30% chance to win at Wimbledon, and yours says that he has a 50% chance instead, then perhaps we both revise our estimates to 40%. But we don't necessarily have to meet in the middle. If you're more up on Lindsay Lohan gossip than I am, perhaps I capitulate to you and concede that your Lindsay Lohan forecast is better, thereby adopting it as my own belief. Either way, we walk away from the meeting with the same number in mind, a revised and, we hope, more accurate forecast about the probability of some real-world event. But sometimes we won't agree. The law of the land says that we must then settle our differences by placing a bet on our forecasts. In Bayes land, you must make one of these two choices: come to a consensus or bet. Otherwise, to a Bayesian, you are not really being rational. If after we have our little chat, you still think your forecast is better than mine, you should be happy to bet on it, since you stand to make money. If you don't, you should have taken my forecast and adopted it as your own. Of course, this whole process would be incredibly inefficient. We'd have to maintain forecasts on thousands and thousands of events and keep a ledger of the hundreds of bets that we had outstanding at any given time. In the real world, this is the function that markets play. They allow us to make transactions at one fixed price, at a consensus price, rather than having to barter or bet on everything. The Bayesian invisible hand. In fact, free market capitalism and Bayes' theorem come out of something of the same intellectual tradition. Adam Smith and Thomas Bayes were contemporaries, and both were educated in Scotland and were heavily influenced by the philosopher David Hume. Smith's invisible hand might be thought of as a Bayesian process in which prices are gradually updated in response to changes in supply and demand, eventually reaching some equilibrium. Or Bayesian reasoning might be thought of as an invisible hand, wherein we gradually update and improve our beliefs as we debate our ideas, sometimes placing bets on them when we can't agree. Both are consensus-seeking processes that take advantage of the wisdom of crowds. It might follow, then, that markets are an especially good way to make predictions. That's really what the stock market is: a series of predictions about the future earnings and dividends of a company. My view is that this notion is mostly right most of the time. I advocate the use of betting markets for forecasting economic variables like GDP, for instance. One might expect these markets to improve predictions for the simple reason that they force us to put our money where our mouth is and create an incentive for our forecasts to be accurate. Another viewpoint, the efficient market hypothesis, makes this point much more forcefully. It holds that it is impossible under certain conditions to outpredict markets. This view, which was the orthodoxy in economics departments for several decades, has become unpopular given the recent bubbles and busts in the market, some of which seemed predictable after the fact. But the theory is more robust than you might think. And yet, a central premise of this book is that we must accept the fallibility of our judgment if we want to come to more accurate predictions. To the extent that markets are reflections of our collective judgment, they are fallible too. In fact, a market that makes perfect predictions is a logical impossibility. Justin Wolfers, Prediction Markets Cop. If there were really a Bayes land, then Justin Wolfers, a fast-talking, ponytailed polymath who is among America's best young economists, would be its chief of police, writing a ticket anytime he observed someone refusing to bet on their forecasts. Wolfers challenged me to a dinner bet after I wrote on my blog that I thought Rick Santorum would win the Iowa caucus. Bucking the prediction market in trade, as well as my own predictive model, which still showed Mitt Romney ahead. In that case, I was willing to commit to the bet, which turned out well for me after Santorum won by literally just a few dozen votes after a weeks-long recount. But there have been other times when I have been less willing to accept one of Wolfer's challenges. Presuming you are a betting man, as I am, what good is a prediction if you aren't willing to put money on it? Wolfer's is from Australia, where he supported himself in college by running numbers for a bookie in Sydney. He now lives in Philadelphia, where he teaches at the Wharton School and writes for the Freakonomics blog. I visited Wolfer's at his home, where he was an outstanding host, having ordered a full complement of hoagie sandwiches from Sarcone's to welcome me, my research assistant Arikia Milliken, and one of his most talented students, David Rothschild. But he was buttering me up for a roast. Wolfer's and Rothschild had been studying the behavior of prediction markets like Intrade, a sort of real-life version of Baseland, in which traders buy and sell shares of stock that represent real-world news predictions, everything from who will win the Academy Award for Best Picture to the chance of an Israeli airstrike on Iran. Political events are especially popular subjects for betting. One stock, for instance, might represent the possibility that Hillary Clinton would win the Democratic nomination in 2008. The stock pays a dividend of $100 if the proposition turns out to be true, Clinton wins the nomination, but nothing otherwise. However, the traders can exchange their shares as much as they want until the outcome is determined. The market price for a share thus represents a consensus prediction about an outcome's likelihood. At one market, shares in Clinton's stock crashed to $18 after she lost the Iowa caucuses, rebounded to $66 when she won the New Hampshire primary, and slowly drifted back down towards zero as Obama outlasted her in the campaign. Markets like these have a long tradition in politics, dating back to at least the 1892 presidential election, when stocks in Grover Cleveland and Benjamin Harrison were traded just steps away from the American Stock Exchange. "You should tell Nate about the comparison paper," Wolfer said to Rothschild a few minutes into lunch, a mischievous grin on his face. "I did a paper for an academic journal that looked at debiased internet-based polling, compared it to prediction markets in 2008, showing they were comparable," Rothschild volunteered. "That's way too polite," Wolfers interrupted. "It was Intrade versus Nate." "And Intrade won," Rothschild said. Rothschild's paper, which was published in Public Opinion Quarterly, compared the forecasts I made at 538 over the course of the 2008 election cycle with the predictions at Intrade. It concluded that, although 538's forecasts had done fairly well, Intrade's were better. The benefits and limitations of group forecasts. I have some quarrels with the paper's methodology. Intrade's forecasts beat 538's only after Wolfer's and Rothschild made certain adjustments to them after the fact. Otherwise, 538 won. Perhaps more important, a new forecast at 538 fairly often moved the Intrade price in the same direction, suggesting that the bettors there were piggybacking off it to some extent. Nevertheless, there is strong empirical and theoretical evidence that there is a benefit in aggregating different forecasts. Across a number of disciplines, from macroeconomic forecasting to political polling, simply taking an average of everyone's forecast, rather than relying on just one, has been found to reduce forecast error, often by about 15 or 20%. But before you start averaging everything together, you should understand three things. First, while the aggregate forecast will essentially always be better than the typical individual's forecast, that doesn't necessarily mean it will be good. For instance, aggregate macroeconomic forecasts are much too crude to predict recessions more than a few months in advance. They are somewhat better than individual economists' forecasts, however. Second, the most robust evidence indicates that this wisdom of crowds principle holds when forecasts are made independently before being averaged together. In a true betting market, including the stock market, people can and do react to one another's behavior. Under these conditions, where the crowd begins to behave more dynamically, group behavior becomes more complex. Third, although the aggregate forecast is better than the typical individual's forecast, it does not necessarily hold that it is better than the best individual's forecast. Perhaps there is some polling firm, for instance, whose surveys are so accurate that it is better to use their polls and their polls alone rather than dilute them with numbers from their less accurate peers. When this property has been studied over the long run, however, the aggregate forecast has often beaten even the very best individual forecast. A study of the Blue Chip Economic Indicators Survey, for instance, found that the aggregate forecast was better over a multi-year period than the forecasts issued by any one of the 70 economists that made up the panel. Another study by Wolfers, looking at predictions of NFL football games, found that the consensus forecasts produced by betting markets were better than about 99.5% of those from individual handicappers. And this is certainly true of political polling. Models that treat any one poll as the Holy Grail are more prone to embarrassing failures. Reducing error by 15 or 20% by combining forecasts may not sound all that impressive, but it's awfully hard to beat in a competitive market. So I told Wolfers and Rothschild that I was ready to accept the principle behind their conclusion, if not all the details. After all, bettors at Intrade can use 538's forecasts to make their predictions as well as whatever other information they deem to be relevant, like the forecasts issued by our competitors, some of which are also very good. Of course, the bettors could interpret that information in a biased fashion and get themselves into trouble. But it is not like the 538 forecasts, or anybody else's, are beyond reproach. Wolfers seemed disappointed that I was willing to concede so much ground. If I wasn't sure I could beat Intrade, why not just join them and adopt their predictions as my own? "I'm surprised by your reaction, actually," he told me. "If there's something else that should beat it and does beat it, what's the point of doing what you're doing? For one thing, I find making the forecasts intellectually interesting, and they help to produce traffic for my blog. Also, while I accept the theoretical benefits of prediction markets, I don't know that political betting markets like Intrade are all that good right now. The standard of competition is fairly low. Intrade is becoming more popular, but it is still small potatoes compared with the stock market or Las Vegas. In the weeks leading up to the Super Tuesday primaries in March 2012, for instance, about $1.6 million in shares were traded there. By contrast, $8 million is traded in the New York Stock Exchange in a single second. The biggest profit made by any one trader from his Super Tuesday bets was about $9,000, which is not enough to make a living, let alone to get rich. Meanwhile, Intrade is in a legal gray area, and most of the people betting on American politics are from Europe or from other countries. There have also been some cases of market manipulation or blatant irrational pricing there. And these markets haven't done very well at aggregating information in instances where there isn't much information worth aggregating, like in trying to guess the outcome of Supreme Court cases from the nebulous clues the justices provide to the public. Could 538 and other good political forecasters beat Intrade if it were fully legal in the United States and its trading volumes were an order of magnitude or two higher? I'd think it would be difficult. Can they do so right now? My educated guess is that some of us still can, if we select our bets carefully. Then again, a lot of smart people have failed miserably when they thought they could beat the market. The Origin of Efficient Market Hypothesis. In 1959, a 20-year-old college student named Eugene Fama, bored with the Tufts University curriculum of Romance Languages and Voltaire, took a job working for a professor who ran a stock market forecasting service. The job was a natural fit for him. Fama was a fierce competitor who had been the first in his family to go to college and who had been a star athlete at Boston's Malden Catholic High School, despite standing at just 5'8". He combed through data on past stock market returns, looking for anything that could provide an investor with an advantage, frequently identifying statistical patterns that suggested the stock market was highly predictable and an investor could make a fortune by exploiting them. The professor almost always responded skeptically, advising Fama to wait and see how the strategies performed in the real world before starting to invest in them. Almost always, Fama's strategies failed. Equally frustrated and fascinated by the experience, Fama abandoned his plans to become a high school teacher and instead enrolled at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business, where in 1965 he managed to get his PhD thesis published. The paper had something of the flavor of the baseball statistician Bill James' pioneering work during the 1980s, leaning on a mix of statistics and sarcasm to claim that much of the conventional wisdom about how stocks behaved was pure baloney. Studying the returns of dozens of mutual funds in a 10-year period from 1950 to 1960, Fama found that funds that performed well in 1 year were no more likely to beat their competition the next time around. Although he had been unable to beat the market, nobody else really could either. A superior analyst is one whose gains are consistently greater than those of the market. Consistency is the crucial word here, since for any given short period of time, some people will do much better than the market and some people will do much worse. Unfortunately, by this criterion, this author does not qualify as a superior analyst. There is some consolation, however. Other more market-tested institutions do not seem to qualify either. The paper, although it would later be cited more than 4,000 times, at first received about as much attention as most things published by University of Chicago graduate students. But it had laid the groundwork for efficient market hypothesis. The central claim of the theory is that the movement of the stock market is unpredictable to any meaningful extent. Some investors inevitably perform better than others over short periods of time, just as some gamblers inevitably win at roulette on any given evening in Las Vegas. But, Fama claimed, they weren't able to make good enough predictions to beat the market over the long run. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Very often we fail to appreciate the limitations imposed by small sample sizes and mistake luck for skill when we look at how well someone's predictions have done. The reverse can occasionally also be true, such as in examining the batting averages of baseball players over short time spans. There is skill there, perhaps even quite a bit of it, but it is drowned out by noise. In the stock market, the data on the performance of individual traders is noisy enough that it's very hard to tell whether they are any good at all. Past performance is not indicative of future results, appears in mutual fund brochures for a reason. Suppose that in 2007 you wanted to invest in a mutual fund, one that focused mostly on large capitalization American stocks, like those that make up the Dow Jones Industrial Average or the S&P 500. You went to E-Trade, which offered literally hundreds of choices of such funds and all sorts of information about them, like the average return they had achieved over the prior 5 years. Surely you would have been better off investing in a fund like EVTMX, Eaton Vance Dividend Builder A, which had beaten the market by almost 10% annually from 2002 through 2006. Or, if you were feeling more daring, JSVAX, Janus Contrarian T, which had invested in some unpopular stocks but had bettered the market by 9% annually during this period. Actually, it wouldn't have made any difference. When I looked at how these mutual funds performed from 2002 through 2006 and compared it with how they performed over the next 5 years from 2007 through 2011, there was literally no correlation between them. EVTMX, the best-performing fund from 2002 through 2006, was only average over the next 5 years, and high-performing JSVAX was 3% worse per year than the market average. As Fama found, there was just no consistency in how well a fund did, even over 5-year increments. Other studies have identified very modest correlations in mutual fund performance from year to year, but it's so hard to tell them apart that you're best off just selecting the one with the cheapest fees or eschewing them entirely and investing in the market yourself. The misery of the Chartist. Fama reserved his harshest criticism, however, for what he called Chartists. People who claim to be able to predict the direction of stock prices, as Fama had tried and failed to do, solely on the basis of past statistical patterns, without worrying about whether the company had made a profit or a loss, or whether it sold airplanes or hamburgers. The more polite term for this activity is technical analysis. Perhaps we should have some sympathy for the poor Chartist. Distinguishing the noise from the signal is not always so easy. In one analysis, I have presented a series of 6 stock market charts. 4 of them are fakes and were literally generated by telling my computer to flip a coin, or rather pick a random series of ones and zeros. The other 2 are real and depict the actual movement of the Dow Jones Industrial Average over the first 1,000 trading days of the 1970s and 1980s, respectively. It isn't so easy to tell which is which. Investors were looking at stock price movements like these and mistaking noise for a signal. 3 forms of efficient market hypothesis. After looking at enough of this type of data, Fama refined his hypothesis to cover 3 distinct cases, each one making a progressively bolder claim about the predictability of markets. First, there is the weak form of efficient market hypothesis. What this claims is that stock market prices cannot be predicted from analyzing past statistical patterns alone. In other words, the chartists' techniques are bound to fail. The semi-strong form of efficient market hypothesis takes things a step further. It argues that fundamental analysis, meaning actually looking at publicly available information on a company's financial statements, its business model, macroeconomic conditions, and so forth, is also bound to fail and will also not produce returns that consistently beat the market. Finally, there is the strong form of efficient market hypothesis, which claims that even private information, insider secrets, will quickly be incorporated into market prices and will not produce above-average returns. This version of efficient market hypothesis is meant more as the logical extreme of the theory and is not believed literally by most proponents of efficient markets, including Fama. There is fairly unambiguous evidence, instead, that insiders make above-average returns. One disturbing example is that members of Congress, who often gain access to inside information about a company while they are lobbied, and who also have some ability to influence the fate of companies through legislation, return a profit on their investments that beats market average by 5 to 10% per year, a remarkable rate that would make even Bernie Madoff blush. But the debates over the weak form and semi-strong forms of the hypothesis have been perhaps the hottest topic in all the social sciences. Almost 900 academic papers are published on the efficient market hypothesis every year, and it is now discussed almost as often in financial journals as the theory of evolution is discussed in biological ones. Efficient market hypothesis is sometimes mistaken for an excuse for the excesses of Wall Street. Whatever else those guys are doing, it seems to assert, at least they're behaving rationally. A few proponents of the efficient market hypothesis might interpret it in that way. But as the theory was originally drafted, it really makes just the opposite case. The stock market is fundamentally and profoundly unpredictable. When something is truly unpredictable, nobody from your hairdresser to the investment banker making $2 million per year is able to beat it consistently. However, as powerful as the theory claims to be, it comes with a few qualifications. The most important is that it pertains to returns on a risk-adjusted basis. Suppose you pursue an investment strategy that entails a 10% chance of going broke every year. This is exceptionally foolish. If you followed the strategy over a 20-year investment horizon, there's only a 12% chance that your money would live to tell about it. But if you are that ballsy, you deserve an excess profit. All versions of the efficient market hypothesis allow for investors to make an above-average return, provided it's proportionate to the additional risks they are taking on. Another important qualification is that profits are measured net of the cost of trading. Investors incur transaction costs every time they trade a stock. These costs are fairly small in most circumstances, perhaps 0.25% of a trade. But they accumulate the more often you trade, and can be quite devastating to an overactive trader. This gives efficient market hypothesis a bit of a buffer zone. Some investment strategies might be a tiny bit profitable in a world where trading was free. But in the real world, a trader needs to earn a large enough profit to cover this additional expense, in somewhat the same way that a winning poker player needs to beat the game by a large enough margin to cover the house's take. A statistical test of efficient market hypothesis. Opponents of efficient market hypothesis have two good ways to attempt to disprove it. One is to demonstrate that some investors are consistently beating the stock market. The other is more direct. Illustrate predictability in the returns. One simple way to refute the hypothesis would be to demonstrate that stock price movements are correlated from one day to the next. If the stock market rises on Tuesday, does that mean it is also more likely to rise on Wednesday? If so, that means that an investor could potentially benefit through a simple strategy of buying stocks each day that the market rises and selling them or shorting them each time that it declines. Depending on how large the investor's transaction costs were, he might be able to beat the market in this way. Suppose that we looked at the daily closing price of the Dow Jones Industrial Average in the 10 years between 1966 and 1975, the decade just after Fama had published his thesis. Over this period, the Dow moved in the same direction from day to day. A gain was followed by a gain, or a loss by a loss, 58% of the time. It switched directions just 42% of the time. That seems non-random, and it is. A standard statistical test would have claimed that there was only about a 1 in 7 quintillion possibility that this resulted from chance alone. But statistical significance does not always equate to practical significance. An investor could not have profited from this trend. Suppose that an investor had observed this pattern for 10 years. Gains tended to be followed by gains and losses by losses. On the morning of January 2, 1976, he decided to invest $10,000 in an index fund, which tracked the Dow Jones Industrial Average. But he wasn't going to be a passive investor. Instead, he'd pursue what he called a manic momentum strategy to exploit the pattern. Every time the stock market declined over the day, he would pull all of his money out, avoiding what he anticipated would be another decline the next day. He'd hold his money out of the market until he observed a day that the market rose, and then he would put it all back in. He would pursue this strategy for 10 years until the last trading day of 1985, at which point he would cash out his holdings for good, surely assured of massive profits. How much money would this investor have at the end of the 10-year period? If you ignore dividends, inflation, and transaction costs, his $10,000 investment in 1976 would have been worth about $25,000 10 years later using the manic momentum strategy. By contrast, an investor who had adopted a simple buy-and-hold strategy during the same decade, buy $10,000 in stocks on January 2, 1976, and hold them for 10 years, making no changes in the interim, would have only about $18,000 at the end of the period. Manic momentum seems to have worked. Our investor, using a very basic strategy that exploited a simple statistical relationship in past market prices, substantially beat the market average, seeming to disprove the efficient market hypothesis in the process. But there's a catch. We ignored this investor's transaction costs. This makes an enormous difference. Suppose that the investor had pursued the manic momentum strategy as before, but that each time he cashes into or out of the market, he paid his broker a commission of 0.25%. Since this investor's strategy requires buying or selling shares hundreds of times during this period, these small costs will nickel and dime him to death. If you account for his transaction costs, in fact, the $10,000 investment in the manic momentum strategy would have been worth only about $1,100 10 years later, eliminating not only his profit, but also almost all the money he put in originally. In this case, there is just a little bit of predictability in stock market returns, but not nearly enough to make a profit from them. And so efficient market hypothesis is not violated. The other catch is that the pattern has since reversed itself. During the 2000s, the stock market changed direction from day to day about 54% of the time, just the opposite of the pattern from earlier decades. Had the investor pursued his manic momentum strategy for 10 years beginning in January 2000, his $10,000 investment would have been whittled down to $4,000 by the end of the decade even before considering transaction costs. If you do consider transaction costs, the investor would have had just $141 left over by the end of the decade, having lost almost 99% of his capital. In other words,